all of a sudden our email campaigns are getting like 5 to 15% response rates, whereas before they were like 2 or 3. It seems like people naturally think that bigger is better, in the sense of the biggest solution out there for X is probably the best one, or the name you think of when you think of marketing analytics is probably the best. I've found personally that that's almost never actually the case.
Behind the scenes, it was a small group of people that were doing everything.
Slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
I want to know how this insane growth actually happened.
What are you doing when no one's around, no one's looking? Are you just showing up and doing the minimum, or are you approaching it like a pro? Be a student of the game.
All right. Before we dive into the episode, you may have heard GTM Fund and GTM Now's announcement about a free tool we launched called Warm Intro Navigator. You know that we've been nerding out about ecosystem-led growth for quite a while now. Really, we see the smartest companies are embracing ecosystem-led growth, or ELG. That's why I'm super excited about our sponsor this week. It is a must-attend conference presented by Crossbeam and the ELG Alliance. It is called the ELG Conference. It's going to be hosted in Austin on May 15th and 16th at the gorgeous Proper Hotel. Get to hear how top SaaS companies are leveraging partner ecosystems in their go-to-market motions, aka ecosystem-led growth. So what you can expect at ELGCon is real-life case studies from companies like Datadog, Cloudera, and many more, chance to tour and maybe even race on Austin's F1 track. I know we got a lot of F1 fans out there, and candid off-the-record conversations. None of this will be recorded. These are real in-person chats. And then a highly curated group of over 200 go-to-market leaders. 85% of those are director level and above across sales, marketing, and partnerships. Early bird tickets expire this week in just 2 days on March 7th. So please go claim your tickets today by going to crossbeam.com/ELG-conference. Again, that's crossbeam.com/ELG-conference. And because you're a listener here, there's even a limited number of special 2-for-1 tickets up there. So hope to see you there, and let's get on with the episode. What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to the GTM podcast. You're hanging out with Scott Barker here. Hopefully you've enjoyed. Sophie, our VP of marketing, is jumping in on some of these now, so you get to hear both of us, but always about our guests. I've got a great one today. I am joined by Stephen Hakami. Stephen, welcome, man.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And quick background for our guests. So Stephen is the founder and CEO of Wizza. Wizza is the most accurate way to find verified contact information for B2B prospects. We all know we need data to supercharge everything we're doing. And it's crazy how I've dove into the data. We've used it. We've seen it. And I remember back in the day, I would need 5 vendors to actually get the accurate data I needed. And the accuracy is off the charts. So kudos for your team there. But Stephen started the company back in 2019 after a sales career frustrated with bad data, and set out to build a prospecting tool powered by live LinkedIn data, so it stays accurate. Talk me through some of that frustration. I mean, we have a ton of sellers on this, and there is nothing more annoying when you're trying to get in front of someone, you're trying to multi-thread, or you know there is an opportunity at this company and you just can't get in front of the right people. Walk me through some of that frustration.
So I was working at a conference company, and the events were always in different places. We had a completely new market to target, and there was always a time crunch because the event would be in 3 months, and after then you can't sell it anymore. You move to a new market. So it was all about how do we get as many leads as quick as possible for somewhere where we didn't have any sort of database. And so we had big name prospecting tools, but everyone just preferred to work off LinkedIn and trusted the data that was on LinkedIn. And it's always more accurate and timely with job titles and the current companies that people are at. So I'd be on LinkedIn, you find the name, you start to search around. There were email finder tools, but it was more kind of pieced together step by step. And then you finally get those contact details. You go into Salesforce, you add the contact information, you click send, and then it's wrong. You've got a bounce. And it took a ton of time. Even as you start to automate it as much as you can with the different pieces, I still found most of my day was spent towards prospecting. And I was just like, there's got to be a tool out there that just scrapes Sales Navigator searches, first of all. and it didn't exist. And I was always generally interested in software. And that was the motivation behind starting the company. We started with exporting from SalesNav, and we've expanded, obviously, Recruiter, and now we have our own prospecting platform. But the whole idea is kind of like you mentioned, it's always powered by live LinkedIn data. It's not a database that we maintain. It's something that is happening live, checking LinkedIn, and then doing those email finding steps.
That's huge. That piece of just in real time, live, is massive. And imagine it's just less upkeep too. I can't imagine some of these companies with these huge databases trying to keep those relevant. So it's cool that you guys are pulling them in real time, because that's a big thing. And that kind of leads to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about is email deliverability is so incredibly important for go-to-market teams. They say 70% of business communication is done through the written word, and the large portion of that is email. So if those emails are not getting through, you're dead in the water. How have you seen the smartest teams structuring their outbound process to ensure emails are getting to where they're supposed to be, whether it's a prospect or looping in a champion's boss? What are they doing to make sure that, you know, reply rates are up, emails are getting replied to, you're not marked as spam? I know just recently I got marked as spam with one of our partners. I just couldn't get through to them anymore. It seems like this black box of Gmail just deciding to do whatever it wants to do.
Yeah, it definitely is a black box. If back in the day, it was so simple. Just make sure your SPF and DKM records are set up and you should be good to go as long as it's not spammy. But it's gotten more complicated. And, you know, Google doesn't want to give up, just like on like Google search with SEO, they don't want people to game the system. So they don't want to give out exactly, you know, what their algorithm goes into to determining if an email is spam. So I think as like an overarching rule of thumb, the best thing to think about when you're thinking of email deliverability, if you're sending cold email campaigns, is what does a normal email account look like to Google? And generally, let's say you're, you know, you just started working at a law firm. You get onboarded, get your email account. The first week, you're not sending too many emails, maybe a few internal emails here and there. Second week, you're more so getting emails than sending. And as time goes on, it's more conversational. You have more back and forth email with external people. So on a new email account, trying to match that volume is effective, because it's all AI on Google's side recognizing this looks like what a spam account looks like. This looks like what a real account looks like. The other piece of that is, what do your emails actually look like? A spam email signs up, their outbox is like 100 of the exact same emails, same subject line, just with name different, job title different. And that's just super easy to catch. There's email warm-up tools that will send internal emails, will send emails to inboxes that get replies to make your account warmed up and look like a real Google account. But even after you do that, if your account's warmed up and you start sending hundreds of emails per day the exact same message, it's going to start going to spam and you're not going to get good reply rates, and you'll think the messaging doesn't work and you'll try and keep changing it. But really, it's a deliverability issue. So that's, you know, a big piece, heavily variating your email copy and subject lines, even amongst like the same campaigns. And then bounces are huge. Like, again, same example, if you're a real email user and, you know, you're at work sending emails, how often do you send to a bounced email if you're not in sales? It's like pretty rare. You email someone and it's like, oh, they left that company, I didn't realize. Or, you know, it happens now and again, maybe call it 1 or 2% of the time. So it's incredibly important to match that. If you're getting like 5% bounce rate, I'd say anything near that or above that is really bad. And you want to either get emails that are pre-validated using something like Wiza, or if you have a different data source, taking those emails to an email verification tool. They're pretty low cost, but they'll take the emails through an SMTP verification. So, you know, you can only send to those valid emails. So I think those three things will have a big impact.
Yeah, I love that. And all super tactical. I might push you on, what are some of the email warm-up tools that you like or recommend?
There's Warmly. We've used Email Warm-Up. A lot of the cold email sending tools that are out there are now starting to integrate them. Like Instantly has their own built-in So they're all generally the same product and they're pretty simple. But yeah, those are some of the ones we've used. There's probably tons more.
Yeah. And then the email verification tools, the pre-validated ones, any ones you like that you can share there?
So not to toot our own horns too much, we're the only ones that'll validate an email as you request it. So a lot of database tools might validate it like once a month, but 30% of the workforce turns over per year and changes emails. So even if it's 1 month, that's going to be like 2.2% bounce rate, which is starting to get up there. So that's for currently validated contact information. But there are tools like Clay, if you do have another data source, where as part of the email finding process, you can add a separate email verifier on top of that. So there's zero bounce, never bounce, emailable. There's so many of these SMTP verification tools, and they're all, you know, more or less the same. But yeah, so those are some of the verification tools.
Yeah, cool. Well, we're on the vein of talking about sales tech companies. What was take on the, so we're recording this, I'm not sure when this is going to go live, but we're recording this the day after they announced their acquisition of Drift. What did you think about that? Net positive for the buyer? What was the sentiment around that?
Yeah, they've been interesting to watch. So I actually saw, apparently this was like a play by the private equity firm that did the buyout before to make it
Vista.
It's not true. I think they already owned a large portion of Drift.
They bought it at the peak. So yeah. They're trying to bring their cost per share down maybe a little bit by guising it as an acquisition by the company that they also, I read a little bit about that too.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It is interesting. But yeah, so we use Intercom for live chat internally, and we've always had, we're a small team, so we're lucky in that like our customer success is very close with sales. And, you know, sometimes someone comes to our live chat and it's actually one of our reps' customers, and we manage that in like a probably inefficient way where it's like a Slack message. So I think bringing those two pieces together for software companies specifically, where, you know, someone comes in for support through a live chat and their rep is able to talk to them, would be super powerful. But yeah, I mean, I think they can play well together. We'll see how they actually, you know, deal with that implementation or if nothing really changes.
Yeah. There's a couple other Vista owned companies in a similar space. Maybe they'll roll them all up one day. Jury's out though on like, is that the consumer says they want consolidation because they want everything cheaper. They want everything to talk to each other, but they also want innovation. And I feel like the trade-off for consolidation is it's much harder for these big companies because they're so busy trying to figure out how all these new systems now work together. So they can't really truly innovate. And I think, you know, right before kind of we had this, we'll call it the AI revolution, everyone was beating the drum of consolidation. All these AI entrants come in and they kind of confuse the market a little bit. And now everyone's jumping and trying all these new AI tools and not so worried about consolidation. What's your take on consolidation of the sales tech stack? Do you think it's going to happen? Or do you think there's always going to be innovators that come up that shake things up?
Yeah, I think for larger companies, consolidation is a lot more important. For smaller companies like ours, where each tool can have like a meaningful impact on our business, like if there's a better email warm-up tool, you know, we'll switch even if our email sequencing tool, you know, has one built in because it's 10% better. And so that might not be worth it for a massive company, but for us, like anywhere we can get an edge is worthwhile. So I think there's always going to be that kind of bottom-up approach where the leaders come from being, you know, super niche and specialized in one certain area. And then over time, you know, they broaden out and become that, you know, consolidation player. But I think the way we started even is kind of the same story. Like we specifically were find leads from LinkedIn Sales Navigator. We only worked with companies that use Sales Navigator. And now we're starting to, you know, expand. And as we've improved data, we, you know, there's a bigger market opportunity as a whole. But I think like, I think there's always going to be those kind of specialist type companies that do one thing really, really well. And they, you know, over time start to broaden out what they offer.
Yeah, I agree. I think it happens across every category. Is actually the consolidation presents opportunity for the innovators more than it hinders them. So switching gears a little bit, I saw this interesting poll on LinkedIn the other day, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but the gist of it was asking salespeople what their aspirations were, where they hope to get to. And you typically think, okay, you're an AE, you want to get to the VP of sales, you want to become a CRO, but actually overwhelmingly more, we'll call it, I think it was like 20% more. Instead of going that track, they actually wanted entrepreneurship. That was what most salespeople are aspiring to, which makes sense. You know, we're all kind of mini entrepreneurs in our own way. You own your territory. And if you do it well, you think of that as your book of business and you own that business and, you know, off to the races. And you've successfully done that. So you started your career in sales. You're now a CEO of a great company. Talk me through that journey, man. I think it could be super inspiring for a lot of the listeners.
Yeah. So I kind of, since a kid, always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I sold all kinds of stuff, just like in school, earphones, hats at the mall, like just, you know, kind of hustling as like a kid since I was really, really young. And I've started so many failed companies. I can't even name them all. My first software company was a company called Restaurant Solutions. I was like 16 years old and I was trying to do iPad ordering at restaurants. And
you were just ahead of your time.
Yeah.
It's coming.
I literally went, I didn't have a driver's license at the time. My brother had to drive me around and I would go like in a suit door to door to restaurants, just trying to say like, hey, be more efficient if people order from iPads. Anyway, I was just selling off like a wireframe. The app wasn't even built, but I learned a lot from kind of that experience and all those failures. But yeah, when I went to university, I still knew like the traditional route wasn't really for me. I knew I wanted to start something. And then I had an opportunity for a sales job at this conference company I'd mentioned. And I jumped at it because it felt like, kind of like you said, like it's really entrepreneurship within, you know, just a larger organization. And it's kind of like training wheels for entrepreneurship where like, okay, you're getting paid a salary, but you can hone your kind of sales skills, conversation skills, all those different things that are important to actually starting and running a business within the kind of comfort of being in a company that already has product market fit. And so, yeah, it was the perfect thing for me. So started in sales there. I was really young when I started there. I think I was like 19. And it was like, it started as like a summer job. But quickly, you know, did well there. In the back of my head, I always knew like, I'm going to leave to start a software company. For some reason, I was always interested in software. I love like the brands in space and I was just like fascinated by it. So I was working sales for a while there. I actually left the job to create a software company called Torch. The idea there was another sales tool, but what it would do is go into your email and find leads that you've sent an email to but haven't followed up with. So this was before when everyone had like automated sequences and it would say like, hey, you emailed Scott 2 weeks ago and you never sent a follow-up, so you should follow up with him. Gmail kind of does that now. Like every once in a while you'll see it. But yeah, it was more for kind of everyone. But didn't really have product market fit. It wasn't a problem. People were like aware that they had and it was very difficult to sell. Went back to the sales job and then had the idea for Wizza with kind of what we had talked about before with the issues around finding contact information off LinkedIn. And yeah, the sales skills I learned were what allowed Wizza to work in the start. Like we're a bootstrap company. We never raised capital and I was doing all the sales, you know. Even now, I still love to get on demos and close deals. But yeah, I'm biased, but I think starting in sales is the best path to entrepreneurship, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah. For sure. If you can't sell, it's very, very difficult to start a company. And yeah, if you're technically brilliant, maybe you can do it, but you still need to go find that co-founder, at least founding AE who can like ride shotgun. But yeah, it's I'm with you on that one. Well, okay, so walk me through, I guess, so you're doing really well at this like conference company. That's an interesting sale too, because you mentioned there's like a time crunch, right? It's not like this customer's not always going to be there. You got to like move quickly and get it done. What were some of the things that kind of made you stand out on that team? Like what drove a lot of your success from that time period? Was it this kind of entrepreneurial mindset that you had, building your own systems, your own process within the confines? What helped you?
Yeah. I think that definitely helped. So I was young when I started there. I was like 19 and I was just like terrified to get on the phone with these like CEOs, CMOs, you know, depending on what the conference was. And it was like a very heavy cold calling organization. Like everyone was on the phones all day. And even when I did make calls, I was like, shit, I'm not very good at this. So I kind of shied away from the phones and I'm like, okay, well then I have to get really good at cold email. So kind of played to my strengths there. And yeah, so I focused in on, you know, if I can send more emails than the rest of the team and they're, you know, and they're effective emails, I'll win. So I focused all my energy on, you know, researching what goes into a good cold email. How do you get high reply rates? What makes people want to respond? What's going to make your email stand out? And I just dove into that while still trying to keep my volume high, which is kind of why I was getting frustrated by how much time I spent prospecting. But yeah, I tried to spend as much time as I could, like crafting really good emails in a way that I could still do at scale in high volumes. One of the best things that worked was finding people where I could find some sort of context. So we were a conference company. We usually, the events had like 2,000 to 3,000 attendees. So it was a good number. So what I would do is download our list of attendees we already had, find those accounts, put all those accounts in LinkedIn Sales Nav, and start to look at other employees at that company and say, hey, others from Apple are already in attendance. So I could still do that in a way that's, you know, kind of scalable. I'm not spending like years writing the emails, but it still creates context rather than just, hey, these are a bunch of people at certain job titles that fit our persona and just start calling them. So that was one thing that worked really well. Another thing I did that was kind of unique is interest. So we had speakers at these conferences. Let's say Simon Sinek is a big name in like the conference space. So finding profiles on LinkedIn where they follow Simon Sinek, for example, and then scraping those lists. And even if you don't mention it directly, like, hey, I saw you like Simon Sinek, your email is still going to stand out a bit more because these are people that know him. So finding different ways to get in touch with the right prospects, I think especially back then, that wasn't really as common. Like it was more just like, who's the idea of job title, industry, headcount? Okay, reach out to these people. And I think now companies are getting smarter with, you know, account-based targeting and who they should go after. But yeah, I think that really helped me and playing my strengths.
Yeah, those little things, they make such a difference, in that I resonate a lot with that feeling of being like young. I mean, like, there's got to be a better way. Like, I know I'm supposed to do it this way, but like you approach it with first principles because you're not indoctrinated in like, you know, the sales process yet. So sometimes you come up with these really creative ways, whether it's, you know, finding out their interests or uploading all the other attendees. Those are great. And like, you can't just like copy those because like they need to be contextual to your business, but they're everywhere in every business that you go. Like, I remember one of my first jobs was like, it was a fintech platform, but it was basically payment processing, which is a commodity. Like, no one cares. It's like they're saving like $10 a month by like tiny little, you know, increments and, you know, 100 cold calls a day. We would just arbitrarily like pick these sectors to go after for like no reason. We'd be like, we're calling dentists this week. Okay, cool. We're calling, you know, doctors next week. Okay, cool. We're calling contractors. And, you know, I remember just out of sheer frustration was just like, okay, who actually needs payment processing? Like, why don't we start there? You know? And it was like, well, if I'm a new business, I don't have one yet. So I don't have to like rip and replace something, which is way harder. Like, let's catch them before they even sign up with anyone else. And I remember finding this new business registry in BC, where I'm from. Every month, they would just give out all the new businesses that were registered or incorporated. And I made that my list. I didn't tell my managers at the first little bit because I wanted to prove it worked first. And like, it went from like booking maybe one meeting a day to booking like 10 meetings a day. It wasn't just like a small increment. It was like a 10x increment change. And then we ended up, you know, adopting it. But those small things, which just requires a little bit of creativity and thought, can have such a huge difference when you're going outbound.
Yeah. No, I love what you said with first principles. Like, you really have to frame, okay, who's the, you know, the best customer for this? Where would it be the easiest? One thing I saw early on in my career was like, no one's going to buy unless your solution is 10 times better than what they're doing right now. And so trying to think like, where out there are the customers where what we offer is 10 times better than what they have now, you know? And sometimes it's in like less obvious places than you'd expect.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I love it, man. Well, I want to go quickly to a listener question because I really like this question and I think you'll have some good input here. So the question is, what is the hardest lesson you've learned throughout your sales career? And then secondary question, similar, what's one mistake you'll never make again?
Okay, so yeah, they're similar. I think the biggest one for me personally was not knowing your competitors well enough. And it's just like, it's such a wasted opportunity when you get, you know, you get someone on the phone or in a demo and they ask about X competitor or they're currently using X competitor and you can't specifically speak to every single thing about that. So I look back on all the calls I had taken on Wizzit where I was just so focused on, hey, this is what we offer. This is what we do. And not paying attention to what do they do now? Where are the strengths in that tool and the weaknesses in that tool or solution? Because I think it's just, yeah, it makes you look like much more of an expert, I think, in the space and someone they can trust when you know exactly the process of, you know, what they're doing today or what other tools they're evaluating. And you can speak to that. And when you're being compared against, you know, the sales rep who doesn't, you know, they're, oh, never, you know, never heard of that tool or I just quickly kind of is dismissive of it versus someone that's able to say, hey, yeah, I've actually used that tool. This is where that tool is actually really great. So you know, you can build some trust. But if you're looking to find X, if you're looking to do Y, here's where we win. So yeah, I think looking back, biggest mistakes I may have been around, you know, not knowing our competitors well enough. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's my biggest one.
Yeah. That's huge. Yeah. It allows you to be like a true consultant, right? We talk about the consultative sale. And like, if you are only an expert in your product, it's only like half the battle. You need to be seen as like an expert in the space. And, you know, talk about, you said building trust. Yeah. There's going to be times, I think, if you're a good seller that you're like, oh, actually, X is probably better for you than what you need like this. And they could be a pseudo competitor. Like, you know, talk to us when you have this problem because we're the world's best in this. But for this little like niche, I would actually go there. Mm. And, you know, those are the ones that will come back. You know, I've had that happen many times. They're like, hey, thank you so much. That solved half of our problem. But now we got these problems. And because you have shown yourself to be a problem solver, next time you have a problem, they have a problem. They come to you because they actually, you know, trust you.
Yeah.
Which is huge.
Yeah. There's another piece. Have you heard of, I think it's called the milkshake experiment?
I don't think so. Tell me about it.
Okay. So I think his name's Jeb Christensen or something like that. He was a Harvard professor on marketing and McDonald's came to him, or I don't know if it was him or he was presenting this, but anyway, they came to this guy and said, you know, we want to sell more milkshakes. How do we do it? And so they went outside McDonald's and they started asking people that had a milkshake, you know, every single little detail about why they made the purchase. And what they found ultimately was McDonald's thought the competitor of the McDonald's milkshake was like Dairy Queen and all these direct other competitors where people could get a milkshake. But when they actually asked people, hey, if you weren't going to buy a McDonald's milkshake, what were you going to buy? It was like an Apple or a Snickers bar. And it was all these competitors that they didn't realize were actually their competitors, but it was really what was solving their problem. So they dug into further. What problem were you looking to solve that led to you considering like a Snickers bar or a McDonald's milkshake? And what they found was that it was people who were generally had like a drive to work and they wanted something that they could easily consume on the way to a meeting or on the way to work or on the road somewhere where it's easy. And, you know, a drink is too quick to drink. They want something slow that's like a bit more filling. And so, yeah, sometimes your competitors are not who you right away think they are. And so you really have to ask either existing customers or people you're talking to, you know, for us, you know, what are you doing to find contact information before looking into Wizza? You know, what other solutions are you looking at? And a lot of times, you know, you think you're competing with like this big other software tool and you're really competing with like Google Sheets, or you're really competing with, you know, some random process. But yeah, your competitors are not always what you directly think they are. And that's, I think, an important thing to know too.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah, it's like you need to be aware of, yeah, the whole competitive landscape. And you can never win a game if you don't know who you're competing against, right? You might have all the information in the world on your top five competitors, but they're sitting across from you and the competitor often is just like doing the same shit that they're doing right now. So what are they doing? And understanding that. I like that. Milkshake example is a great one. Awesome. So, all right. There's a lot of great tools now that can help you with like competitive battle cards and stuff as well. I know there's a Vancouver company that's great called Clue. A lot of people are doing like competitive battle cards, but that's a good takeaway. If your team's battle cards aren't up to date, you know, things are changing so rapidly in the technology space. You know, it's easier to build than ever. Make sure those are up to date, or work with your product marketing team if you have one to create some. All right, man. Well, this has been awesome. As we sort of wrap up, I got two more questions for you, and I keep them intentionally vague so you can take them anywhere you want. First one, it's a hot take. What is one widely held belief that revenue leaders or founders believe to be true that you think is bullshit or no longer serving us?
Yeah. So for me, you know, in demos all the time and just listening to what people at other companies say and evaluating us in our case, the biggest one that comes to mind is, it seems like, and we kind of touched on this earlier, it seems like people naturally think that that bigger is better, in the sense of, you know, the biggest solution out there for X is probably the best one, or the name you think of when you think of marketing analytics is probably the best. And what I've found personally is that that's like almost never actually the case. For me, they're actually usually the worst. And so those kind of like go-to names always get kind of selected within companies as, and they build their whole stack on these, like these platforms. And I think they get stuck and they move slow. And I think it hurts them in the long run. And so, yeah, I think like, kind of like we said earlier with first principles, I think people need to think about, you know, solutions they're considering from first principles and not just blindly trust kind of, you know, the biggest names out there for anything, CRM, this, that, really pick, you know, around what's best for their use case. So that's what comes to mind for me.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's great. Great advice. Yeah, the de facto category leaders are not always the leaders in technology. You know, they're the leaders in brand. You think of how big these companies are. They have a lot of VC money, typically those damn VCs, but they funnel a lot of that into marketing and brand, you know, not always, you know, R&D. And it gets, as you get bigger, it is harder to evolve your product. And so when there's startups that solve a similar problem, they can do so with better support. They can innovate quicker and also will just be more responsive. Like I imagine Wizza, like if a customer comes to you with like a great idea for a product roadmap on your product roadmap, you can do like in real time, like, okay, yeah, we can probably ship that in like 3 months versus like try and do that with a big incumbent. Like we'll see in 3.5 years, you know, if that.
Yeah, 100%.
Awesome, man. Final question. Everyone is looking for things that are actually working. You know, we talk a lot about traditional, you know, predictable revenue model sort of breaking down. We talked about email deliverability and how that's harder than ever. What's just one tactic or strategy that's been working for you and the team at Wizza right now?
Yeah, so it's kind of in line with that, because what happened with us is we started the company, we grew entirely based off cold email, and that's what we focused on.
Drinking your own champagne, baby. I love it.
but it stopped working entirely. And so we kind of parked it. We had a lot of inbound stuff from some of the others, you know, marketing initiatives we had. And so, you know, we focused on that. And a bit less than a year ago, I was like, no, if we're selling data, then certainly we should be people that know about cold email. And so like, let's figure out this problem. And so, yeah, really focusing in on deliverability. Some other pieces to that was that no email inbox sends more than like 20, 30 emails per day. So we rotate like a high number of email inboxes. None of the templates look the same. We make sure the reply rates are good. Otherwise, we kill the campaign immediately. So all these steps around email deliverability, and all of a sudden our email campaigns are getting like 5 to 15% response rates, whereas before they were like 2 or 3.
5 to 15% is strong. Super, super.
Yeah. High. And again, under the right context of people. Yeah. And so, yeah, kind of doubling it down on that deliverability piece made us realize, oh, it wasn't actually like a copy issue or reaching out to the wrong people. It was, we had all these issues with deliverability. And now that we've kind of figured it out, again, it's gotten more complex. Now that we figured it out, cold email is massive, massive channel for us again. So I think people are giving up on it. And I think it just takes a bit more work, but it's still super, super viable.
Yeah, I like it. So one thing you said there, so 20, 30 emails, are your reps then, the ones in charge of doing outbound, are they managing multiple, do they have multiple like domains to allow them to send more?
Yeah, we have separate domains and usually it's a separate subdomain. So hey.getwizza.com. hello@getwizza.com. And so those are all treated separately by Google. It would be a pain for the reps to have to manage themselves. So we have someone on the team that's really, you know, an expert in this. And so he runs the campaigns for the reps. They say who they want to target. He works with them on building the list. They each have about 10 email accounts. And it's super low volume. The email warm-up tool runs forever. It doesn't stop once the email is warmed up. So the reply rates, even if we're getting 5% on a campaign, email warm-up ones are all replied to. So if you average it out across the inbox, it's like 50 to 60%. Looks great to Google. Other housekeeping stuff, a way to opt out so you're not sent, clicked, reported as spam is, of course, key. Variations in emails, we talked about not having a high bounce rate, ideally less than 1%. I think those are the main ones.
I love it. Have you done, we got to publish stuff. There's so many good tactics in here on email deliverability. We'll have to publish some stuff together. Yeah. Or if you've done so already, we'll put it in the show notes. But this has been great, man. Lots of tactical stuff. Thanks for sharing your story. And the great thing about Wizza too, if people are now interested, you want to go check it out. Pretty low barrier to entry. People can just like go sign up and see what the data is all about, right?
Yeah, it's free to get started. You get 20 free leads to try. But it's fully month to month as well. There's no big long-term contracts.
Go check it out. That's wizza.com. Who doesn't want 20 free leads? Make it happen. But thank you, man. It was good chopping it up. We've really enjoyed partnering with you and the team. Excited to see you continue to crush 2024. And for all those listeners that hung out with us, thank you. And of course, I always say it, listening is one thing, executing is something totally different. So hopefully you take some of the things that we talked about, apply it to your business, go out and crush this quarter. And we'll see you next week.